Chapter 5. Jaktha. To indulge it is to breed it. To punish it is to feed it. Madness knows no bridle but the knife. Skilvendi Proverb. When others speak, I hear naught but the squawking of parrots. But when I speak, it always seems to be the first time. Each man is the rule of the other, no matter how mad or vain. Hatatian. Exhortations. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Jaktha. Strange, this feeling. Curiously childlike, though when he racked his soul, Ikuri Confess could find no resembling childhood memory. It was as though he'd been bruised beneath the skin, on his heart, or even his soul. A strange sense of fragility dogged his every look, his every word. He no longer trusted his face. It was as though certain muscles had been removed. For some, it is a defect carried from the womb. What did that mean? The disarming of his men occurred beyond Karaskan's walls, across a fallow millet field. There were no incidents, though Confess very nearly snapped his teeth presiding over it. Columnaries who could sleep in formation suddenly found the most basic commands unintelligible. Several watches passed before all the various units were numbered and disarmed. When it was completed, his columns, shorn of armor and insignia, looked little more than an assembly of half-starved beggars. Innumerable onlookers jeered from the walls. Riding along their forward lines, Nerse Proyas called on those who had given themselves to the warrior prophet to abandon their ranks. "The nations of our birth," he cried, "no longer command us. The customs of our fathers no longer command us. Our blood has ceased answering to what has come before. Destiny, not history, is our master." There was a moment of accusatory indecision, then the first defectors began pressing their way through their orthodox brothers. The traitors gathered behind Proyas, some defiant, others mute, and for a moment it seemed the formations would dissolve in a mass exodus. Confess watched, stone-faced, his innards churning. Then, as though a soundless horn had pealed, the defection stopped. Confess could scarce believe his eyes. The ranks remained intact. Fewer than 1 in 5 had left their places. Fewer than 1 in 5. Obviously vexed, Proyas spurred his horse down a lane between the formations, shouting, "You are men of the Tusk!" "We are veterans of Kaiuth," someone bawled in a drillmaster's voice. "We answer to the Lion," another cried. "The Lion!" For a heartbeat, Confess could scarce believe his ears. Then, as one, the hard-hearted survivors of the Celial and Nasaret columns roared their approval. The shouting continued, growing in desperation and fury. Someone threw a stone which clipped Proyas's helm. The prince retreated, swearing in fury. Confess raised his forearm in imperial salute, and his men raised theirs in thundering reply. Tears clouded his eyes. The bruise of his indignities began to fade, especially when he heard Proyas declare the terms extended by the warrior prophet. Confess could scarcely conceal his glee. Apparently, the Scarlet Spires had managed to relay a message to their mission in Momum via Carathuzel and thence to Zarias. This meant that a forced march back across Kamema, which, perils aside, would have seriously compromised his timetable, was no longer necessary. Instead, he and the remnants of his columns would be interned at Jaktha, where they would await a fleet of transports that had been dispatched by his uncle. No matter who threw the number sticks, it seemed, he owned the results. The following march along the River Oras to Jaktha was uneventful. He spent much of the ride lost in thought, reviewing explanation after explanation. His staff followed at a discreet distance, watching with strange eyes, never daring to speak unless directly addressed. Periodically, he asked them questions.
"Tell me, what man doesn't aspire to godhead?"
The consensus was, not surprisingly, absolute. All men, they said, sought to emulate the gods, though only the most bold, the most honest, dared voice their ambitions. Of course, the fools simply mouthed what they thought he wanted to hear. Ordinarily, this would have incensed Confis. No command could tolerate sycophants. But his uncertainty made him curiously indulgent. After all, according to the so-called warrior prophet, his was a marred soul, a deformation born of the womb. The famed Icuri Confis was not quite human. The strange thing was that he understood full well what the man had meant. His entire life, Confis had known he was different. He never stammered in embarrassment. He never blushed in the presence of his betters. He never minced his words with his worries. All around him, men jerked this way and that, pulled by hooks that he knew only by reputation. Love, guilt, duty. Though he understood how to use these words well enough, they meant nothing to him. And the strangest thing of all was that he didn't care. Listening to his officers oblige his vanity, Confis came to a powerful realization. His beliefs mattered nothing, so long as they delivered what he wanted. Why make logic the rule? Why make fact the ground? The only consistency that mattered, the only correspondence, was that between belief and desire. If it pleased him to think himself divine, then so he would think. And Confis understood that just as he possessed the remarkable ability to do anything, no matter how merciful or bloodthirsty, he also possessed the ability to believe anything. The warrior prophet could hang the ground vertical, make all things fall toward the horizon, and Confis need only point sideways to restore the order of up and down. Perhaps the sorcerer's tales of the consult and the second apocalypse were true. Perhaps the Prince of Atrathau was some kind of savior. Perhaps his soul was deformed. It simply did not matter if he did not care. So he told himself that his life was his witness, that ages had passed without producing a soul such as his, that the whore of fate lusted for him and him alone.
"The fiend couldn't attack you outright," General Sompas ventured, "not without risking more bloodshed, more losses."
The caste noble raised a hand against the sun to look directly at his exalt general.
"So he heaped infamy on your name, kicked dirt across your fire, so that he alone might illumine the councils of the great."
Even though he knew the man simply flattered him, Confis decided that he agreed. He told himself that the Prince of Atrathau was the most accomplished liar he'd ever encountered, a veritable ajokli. He told himself that the council had been a trap, the product of thorough rehearsal and painstaking premeditation. So he told himself, and so he believed. For Confis, there was no difference between decision and revelation, manufacture and discovery. Gods made themselves the rule, and he was one of them. By the time he sighted Joktha's staunch towers on the fourth day, the bruise had utterly vanished. The old iron smirk reassumed command of his expression. "I," Confis thought to himself, "have willed this." Peering through the scattered hemlock trees, he idly surveyed his prison. Unlike most cities encountered by the men of the Tusk, Joktha's curtain walls largely ignored the advantages of terrain. The location had been chosen for its natural harbor, which was merely the largest on a coastline pocked with several such harbors. The landward fortifications formed a long wandering line, gray as bands of iron in the sun, intersected by the small city's single gate, the Great Barbican of the Tooth, so named because of the white tile adorning its exterior. From his vantage on the banks of the Oros, Confis could see little of the city, save for the hazy heights of what was called the Donjon Palace, the stronghold of the city's masters. The surrounding countryside, though green and overgrown, betrayed the turmoil of the past season. Not a field had been planted. The orchards had been hacked to stumps. The encircling hills loomed dark, lined with ancient terracing and dotted with derelict villas. An abandoned Canaan fort occupied a low promontory to the south, its stone so battered that it looked more a work of nature than of man. Only glimpses of sky through an intact window revealed its origins. The world seemed as blasted as it should. Suddenly they were riding through a loose stand of pepper trees, and Confis found himself wondering at the wash of their sweet scent in the wind. Old Scaurus had kept pepper trees, an entire grove of them, back when Confis had been his hostage. It had been a notorious rendezvous, particularly for the seduction of slaves. He would need to hold on to such memories, Confis realized, to preserve his resolve through the weeks to come. A captive had to always recall those he had mastered, lest he become one of them. Another of grandmother's lessons. The road they followed veered away from the wooded banks of the Oras, and Confis led his great and miserable train across denuded and fallow ground directly toward the Tooth. What looked like 200 or 300 Khonrian knights awaited them, arrayed to either side of the dark gate. His jailers. He was heartened, even amused, by their lackluster appearance and numbers. The sight of the Skilvendi leaning on his pommel, however, struck his amusement dead. The man wore his hauberk bare, save for the thick Skilvendi girdle about his waist. His black hair tangled about the folds of his male hood, a compliment to the Kianine scalps that fluttered from his horse's bridle. Why him? The Prince of Atrathau was a fiend, a cunning, cunning fiend, even still. Even still. Exult General. Scowling, Confis turned to his general. What is it, Sompas?
How?
The man sputtered. His eyes flashed with scarcely restrained fury.
How does he expect?
The conditions are clear. I retain my freedom so long as I remain within Jokthar's walls. I retain my staff and all the slaves that service it. I'm heir to the mantle, Sompas. To antagonize me is to antagonize the Empire. So long as they think me neutered, they'll play their game by the rules.
But,
Confis scowled. Martimus had never hesitated with his questions, but then neither had he feared Confis. Not really. Perhaps Sompas was the smarter man.
You think we've been humiliated?
This is an outrage, Exult General, an outrage!
It was the Skilvendi, Confis realized. The disarming had been salt enough, but to submit to a Skilvendi? He mused for a moment, surprised that he'd thought only of the implications and nothing of this slight. Had the past months sheared away so many of the old intuitions? You're mistaken, General. The warrior prophet does us a favor.
Favor? How?
Sompas trailed as though horrified by his own vehemence. The man was forever forgetting and remembering his place. Confis found it quite amusing, actually.
Of course. He's returned to me my most precious possession.
The fool could only stare.
My men. He's returned to me my men. He's even culled them for me.
But we are disarmed.
Confis looked back at the great train of beggars that was his army. They looked shadowy in the dust, at once dark and pale, like a legion of wraiths too insubstantial to threaten, let alone harm. Perfect. He glanced one last time at his general.
Hold on to your worries, Sompas.
He turned back to the Skilvendi, raising his hand in the mockery of a salute.
Your dismay, he muttered askance, lends the stamp of authenticity to these proceedings.
I'm forgetting something.
The terrace was broad. The marmoreal paving stones were cracked here and there, as might be expected in a nation that suffered frost, but not in Anathpania. Even in the dark, they were clearly visible, like rivers inked across maps. Cracks. No doubt the original residents had their slaves cast carpets over the offending stones, at least while entertaining guests. No Phaenum prince would tolerate such a defect. No Enrithi lord. Only an Utamat chieftain. Nayur nodded, rubbed his eyes, stamped his foot in an effort to stay awake. Blinking, he stared over the balustrade and out across the city and port. Rooftop piled onto rooftop, climbing the near and distant slopes, and forming a broad basin about the piers and quays that ringed the inner harbor. A disheveled landscape of structure struck by streets like river canyons, all leading to the sea. Jokthar. He need only blink to see it burn. Above, innumerable stars dusted the firmament, curving into a perfect bowl so vast, so hollow, that it seemed a single twitch might send him floating skyward, falling. It reminded him of awakening at Kaiuth. He could almost smell his kinsmen sprawling dead in ever-widening gyres.
I'm forgetting.
He drowsed. His copper wine bowl slipped from his fingers and rolled across the cracked stone. Events from the previous evening slurred through his soul. Confis baiting him at the gates. Confis arguing the terms of his internment. Confis restrained by his generals. His cuirass glaring white in the sunlight. His long-lashed eyes.
I'm...
The Skilvindi stirred in sudden remembrance, rolled his head about his massive shoulders.
I'm Neyor, breaker of horses and men.
He laughed, drowsed some more, dreamed. He walked toward Shaima, though it was identical to the Utamat camp of his youth, a congregation of several thousand Yaksh. Herds ranged the surrounding plains, but no cattle dared approach him. He passed the first of the Yaksh, their hides tight against their poles, like skin about the ribs of dogs. The Utamat crowded the lanes between, limbs hanging from rotted sockets, viscera draped across their thighs. He saw all of them, his father's brother, Banut, his brother-in-law, Balait, even Yursalka and his crippled wife. They watched him with the parchment eyes of the dead. He came across the first of his butchered chattel, a brown foal with his threefold mark. Then three cows, their throats cut, followed by a four-year-old bull, its head cudgeled. Soon he found himself climbing across mounds of horse and cattle carcasses, all of them bearing his mark. For some reason, he felt no surprise. Then at last he came to the white Yaksh, the very heart of Shaima. A spear had been driven into the ground next to the entrance. His father's head adorned the haft, pale skin drawn like water-sodden linen. Neyor tore his gaze away, drew aside the doe-skin flap. Somehow he already knew that Moengus had made a harem of his wives, so he was neither shocked nor outraged. But the blood unnerved him, as did the fish-like way Serwe opened and closed her mouth. Anissi was screaming. Moengus looked up from his passion and grinned a broad and welcoming grin.
The Aikyori still lives, he said. Why don't you kill him? The time. Are you drunk? Nepente, all that the bird gave to me.
Ah,
so you yearn to forget after all?
No, not forget. Sleep.
So why not kill him?
Because he wants me to.
The Dunyane? You think this is a trap?
His every word is a feint, his every look a spear.
Then what's his intent?
To keep me from his father, to deny me my hate, to betray.
But all you need do is kill the Aikyori. Kill him, and you are free to follow the holy war.
No, there is something I'm...
You're a fool.
Somehow Neyor raised his face to the muck of wakefulness, peered through ocean-swimming eyes, and saw it perched on the balustrade before him, its scalp polished in starlight, its feathers shot with black silk, the world floating like smoke beyond it.
Bird! He cried. Devil!
The tiny face leered. The eyes became heavy-lidded, like a demon dreaming.
Caius, it said. Where the Aikyori humiliated you and your people. Avenge the Battle of Caius.
I'm forgetting something.
How could absent things remain? How could they be? Each Swazond a dead man, grinning. Each night a dead woman's embrace. Days passed, and Neyor tried hard to fathom the depths that pitched about him. Confis and his Nansor were his immediate concern, or should have been. Proyas had given him the barons Ternimus and Sanumnus with their 370-odd client knights, as well as the 58 survivors of his old band from Shygek. Like all men of the Tusk, they were battle-hardened, but they made no effort to conceal their dismay at having been left behind.
Blame the Nansur, Neyor told them. Blame Confis.
They were thoroughly outnumbered by their Nansur charges, and Neyor needed as much aggression as they could muster. When Baron Sanumnus expressed misgivings, Neyor reminded him that these men had conspired to betray the Holy War, and that no one knew when the Emperor's transports would arrive.
They can overwhelm us at will, he said. So we must strip their will from them.
Of course, he said nothing of his true motives. These men had chosen Ikuri Confis over the Dunyane. One must always chain the dog before murdering the master. A squalid camp of sorts was struck along Jakta's walls, far enough from the Auras to keep a good number of the columnaries occupied with drawing and delivering water. Knowing well the organizational strengths of the Imperial Army, Nayor segregated the older soldiers, the Threezies as they were called, from the younger. The officers he interned in a different camp altogether. Because of the mutual enmity between the largely caste noble cavalrymen and the caste menial infantrymen, Nayor had the Kidrahil dissolved and scattered through the columns. As a further measure, he had his Conryans continually circulate rumors that Confis had been overheard blubbering in his chambers, that the officers had rioted when they learned their rations were no different from the enlisted men's, the kind of rumors that gnawed at every army's heart. Even when universally dismissed, they served to distract idle souls and to drown those truths that did surface. Nayor restricted Confis and the 42 men of his immediate coterie to the city, as per the conditions of internment. He forbade all contact with his columnaries, for obvious reasons. Since imprisoning him outright could provoke a revolt, he allowed the imperial nephew what liberty Jakta provided, even as he obsessively pondered the man's murder. He understood why Kellis wanted Confis dead. The Dunyane suffered no rivals. Likewise, he understood why Kellis had chosen him as his assassin. Of course the savage had killed the lion. Was he not Skilvendi? Was he not a survivor of Kaiuth? What tormented him was what these understandings implied. If murdering Moengus was Kellis's sole mission, then preserving the Holy War should be his sole concern. Why assassinate Confis when he need only remove him from the game, as he had? And why use Nayor to conceal his involvement when the consequences, open war with the Empire, would have no bearing on the imminent conquest of Shaima? And Nayor realized there was no way around it. The Dunyane was looking beyond the Holy War, past Shaima. And to see past Shaima was to see past Moengus. Men draped assumptions, endless assumptions, about their acts. They could scarce do otherwise, given the errant hunger for meaning. Since the beginning, Nayor had conceived their journey as a hunt, as a collusion of enemies in pursuit of a greater foe. Their quest had always seemed an arrow fired into darkness. No matter how deep his misgivings, he had always come back to this understanding. But now it seemed like nothing other than a collar, that Moengus and Kellis, father and son, were but different ends of a mighty torque that he, Nayor Ur-Skiotha, had bent about the very neck of the world, a slaver's collar. Something. He found himself scrutinizing Ternemis and Sanumnus whenever the opportunity afforded. Baron Ternemis, he quickly decided, was an outright fool, a man more bent on recovering the belly he had lost at Karaskan than anything else. Sanumnus, on the other hand, was both clever and taciturn, and seemed to wield an obvious yet inexplicable authority over his stouter countrymen. He was a watcher. Had they been given secret orders? Orders that made one the senior? That would explain why Ternemis deferred and Sanumnus watched. What, after all, would be the penalty for murdering the Nansor Emperor's only heir, for contravening the warrior prophet's solemn vow?
I've been sent to murder myself.
The thought made Nayor cackle. Small wonder Proyas had been so unnerved, relaying the Dunyane's murderous instructions. The fact that he had been assigned a schoolman only provided further confirmation of his suspicions. Sornemi, he was called, a young scarlet initiate with a fey and chronic cough. He had arrived the day after Confis, accompanied by a sorcerer of rank, Inrumi, who departed immediately and inexplicably after inspecting his student's quarters. Sornemi, the older sorcerer had told Nayor, was to be his link to the Holy War. The boy, as the pompous fool referred to him, was to sleep until noon every day so they might converse through sorcerous dreams. Sornemi, in other words, was to be the Dunyane's eyes in Jaktha. Depths. Everywhere he turned, mad, unfathomable depths. Provoked by Sornemi's presence, Nayur ordered Ternemis to gather Confis and his staff in the petition hall of the Donjon Palace, the citadel where Nayur had made his headquarters. He bid the young sorcerer study their captives from the balcony. Then, once the exalt general and his men had assembled, Nayur strode into their very midst, staring hard into various faces and taking pleasure in the way they blanched. The Nansor were such predictable scum, courageous in excess when armed in mobs, but cowering fawns when outside formation. He found himself circling Confis, who stood ramrod straight in full military dress.
"You see your brothers on my arms," he declared to the others. "Your wives," he spat at the feet of those nearest. "How it must go."
"How many of your brothers," Confis cried out, "do I bear on my—"
Nayur struck him. The exult general sailed backward, tripped to the ground. Nayur whirled to the sound of slapping sandals, caught an arcing wrist. He seized his assailant's cuirass, smashed the man's face against his forehead. The dagger the fool had concealed clattered across the shining tiles.
"These dogs had to be broken. Broken."
The sound of swords whisking from sheaths. Ternemus's Conryan suddenly appeared about him, blades outstretched. The Nansor backed away, ashen-faced. Several called out to their exalt general, who had rolled onto all fours, spitting blood.
"Make no mistake,"
Nayur roared over their cries.
"You will heed me."
He brought a boot down on the head of the man jerking at his feet. The ingrate went still, as though wrinkles had been smoothed from his limbs. Hot blood slipped along the cracks between tiles. A moment of wilting silence.
"Do not,"
Nayur said, raising his great banded arms.
"Make me the ledger of your folly."
He could almost see them shrink. Suddenly they seemed children, frightened children, beneath the soaring pillars. His heart hammering in exultation, Nayur spat again, then raised his face to Sornemi, who watched from the gallery above, his adolescent frame bundled in silken crimson. His beard, Nayur noted, was little more than a mummer's gag.
"Which one?"
he called. Sornemi coughed the inane way he always did, then nodded toward the back of the crowd at the men milling about General Sampas.
"That one," he said. "The one with—"
another ceremonial cough, too soft to cut real phlegm.
"With the silver bindings about his cuirass."
Grinning, Nayur reached beneath his girdle, extracted his father's koray. Without warning, the slender man to Sampas's right bolted across the polished floors. He was felled after five strides, a shaft jutting from the back of his neck. He cried out, began screaming words that made smoke of sound. His eyes flared bright, but Nayur was already upon him. Incandescence searing every surface chalk white. Men raised arms, cried out. The Nansor blinked and gaped. Nayur turned to them, away from the broken salt statuary at his feet. He spat and grinned, then strode towering into their midst. He made for Confis. The exalt general sputtered, shrank from his approach, but Nayur merely brushed past him, continued wordlessly up the monumental stair. One did not trade words with whipped dogs. It was mummery, Nayur knew, but then everything was mummery in the end. Another lesson learned at the Dunyane's heel. Afterward, he found himself screaming in his apartments. He understood why, of course. If not for the Scarlet Schoolman's arrival, he would never have thought that Confis, too, had a sorcerer. But the why of this understanding escaped him. It always escaped him. Was something wrong with him? Enemies, all about him enemies. They even dwelt within. Even Proyas. Could he bring himself to break his neck as well?
He sent me to murder myself.
At night, Nayur drank, heavily, and the spears that lay hidden beneath every surface were blunted. The terrors rather oozed from the cracks in the floor. Despite the censers, the air smelled of Yaksh, earth, smoke, and moldering hides, he could hear Moengus whisper through the dim interiors. More lies, more confusions. And the bird, the fucking bird. It seemed a knot, a yanking of all things foul into a single form. His chest tightened, simply thinking of it. But of course it couldn't be real, no more than Serwe. He told her as much every night she came to his bed.
Something is wrong with me.
He knew this because he could see himself as the Dunyain saw him. He understood that Moengus had knocked him from the tracks of his people, that he had spent 30 years kicking through the grasses, searching for the spoor of his own passing, for a way back. 30 accursed years. These two he understood. The Skilvendi were a forward people, as were all people, save the Dunyain. They listened to their storytellers. They listened to their hearts. Like dogs, they barked at strangers. They judged honor and shame the way they judged near and far. In their inborn conceit, they made themselves the absolute measure. They could not see that honor, like nearness, simply depended on where one stood, that it was a lie. Moengus had lured him onto different ground. How could his kinsmen not think him an obscenity when his voice came to them from darknesses unseen? How could he rediscover their tracks when all grounds had been trampled? He could never be of the people, not after Moengus. He could never think or curse himself back to their savage innocence. He had been a fool to try. Ignorance was ever the iron of certainty, for it was as blind to itself as sleep. It was the absence of questions that made answers absolute, not knowledge. To ask, this was what Moengus had taught him, simply to ask.
Why follow this track and not another?
Because the voice demands it.
Why follow this voice and not another?
That everything could be overthrown so easily. That all custom and conviction could lay so close to the brink, that outrage and accusation could be the only true foundations, all of it, everything that was man, perched on swords and screams. Why? Cried his every step. Why? Cried his every word. Why? Cried his every breath. For some reason. There must be some reason. But why? Why? The world itself had become his rebuke. He was no longer of the land, but he could not beat the step from the cant of his limbs. He was no longer of the people, but he could not wash his father from his blood. He cared nothing for the ways of the Skilvendi, nothing. Yet still they howled within him, railed and railed. He was not of the people, yet still his degradations choked him. Still his longings clawed at his heart.
Wuthrum, shame.
Absent things, how could absent things remain? Each time he shaved, his thumb unerringly found the Swazond puckered about his throat. He would track its ginger course.
Something, I'm forgetting something.
There were two pasts. Nayor understood that now. There was the past that man remembered, and there was the past that determined, and rarely, if ever, were they the same. All men stood in thrall of the latter, and knowing this made them insane. Timing. Few things did Icuri Confis ponder more. The lords of the Holy War might begrudge them these lands, but the Nansor still held the keys. Joktha was an old imperial possession with old imperial ways. Familiar with the perils of governing conquered peoples, long-dead Nansor planners had excavated hundreds of tunnels in hundreds of different cities. Walls, after all, could be retaken. Corpses could only be burned. Nevertheless, escaping the city had proven far more stressful than Confis had expected. Though he was loath to admit it, the incident with the Skilvendi in the Donjon Palace had rattled him. Almost as much as losing Durastius, his sake caller, had inconvenienced him. The savage had struck him, batted him to the floor as easily as a woman or child, and against all expectation, Confis had been paralyzed, utterly incapacitated with fear. Lean, wild, with unnameable hungers, Neyor Ur-Sciotha had seemed the very reaver worshipped by his people. He even stank of the steppe, as though somehow bound within that astounding frame lay earth, Skilvendi earth. Confess had thought himself dead. Of course, he realized, this was precisely the reaction the barbarian wanted. Frightened men, as the Galioth said, thought with their skins. But for some reason, knowing this had made precious little difference. A thought-numbing dread had dogged every turn of their escape. Waiting for nightfall, passing through the streets to the necropolis, excavating the entrance to the tunnels, only when he and Sampas crossed the river Oras did breath come to him easily, and even then. Now, accompanied by a small band of Kidrahil, they waited at the designated rendezvous, an overgrown cairn located near the heart of what had been Imbeyan's hunting preserve, several miles to the south and east of Jaktha. The site had been Confess's choice, as it should be, since he inevitably would occupy the heights of the drama to follow. A series of titanic gusts broke and fumbled across the earth. The ragged evergreens answered, bending back like girls with their faces to the wind. Winter detritus flew, caught up in the sweeping of invisible skirts. Distant treetops shook, as though concealing some monstrous feud beneath their bowers. Everything, it seemed, had conspired to create the sensation of depth. So often the world seemed flat to Confess, like something painted across his eyes. Not so today, he mused. Today would be deep. Sampas's chestnut snorted, shook its head and mane to shoo a wasp. The general cursed in the petulant way of those who keep score with animals. Suddenly, Confess found himself mourning the loss of Martimus. Sampas was useful. Even now, his pickets combed the countryside, searching for the Skilvendi's spies. But his value lay more in his availability than his quality. He was an able tool, not a foil, as Martimus had been. And all great men required foils, especially on occasions such as this. If only he could forget the accursed Skilvendi. What was it about the man? Even now, in some small corner of his soul, a beacon fire burned at the ready in case of his return. It was as though the barbarian had somehow stained him with the force of his presence, and now it clung, like an odor that must be scrubbed rather than rinsed away. Never had any man possessed such an effect on him. Perhaps this, Confess mused, was what sin felt like for the faithful, the intimation of something greater watching, the sense of disapproval, at once immense and ineffable, as near as fog and yet as distant as the world's rim. It was as though anger itself possessed eyes. Perhaps faith was a kind of stain as well, a kind of odor. He laughed aloud, not caring what Sampas or the others thought. His old self had returned, and he liked his old self very much.
"Exalt General," Sampas said.
"Biaxi fool, always so desperate to be on the inside of things."
"They come,"
Confess said, nodding to the distance. A band of riders, perhaps 20 strong, had cleared the bowers of a cypress stand and were filing down the opposing slope, picking their way between the hummocks that jutted from the pasture like the moles on a dog's chin. Affecting boredom, Confess stole a glance at his small retinue, saw the first brows furrow in confusion and concern. He almost cackled aloud. What was he up to, their godlike exult general? This day had been planned long in advance. The Prince of Atrathau had wasted no time securing his authority over the Holy War. Whatever spleen the Orthodox yet possessed had been gutted by his victory over the Padiraja. Confess still blinked in wonder, thinking of that day, that such certainty could take root in such desperation. Even his own men had fought with the fury of the possessed. Confess had played his role, and given the narrow margins involved, had no doubt been instrumental to the Holy War's success. But any fool could see his days as a man of the Tusk were numbered, so he had taken measures. Arranging this assignation through Sarangi intermediaries was one of them. So too was secreting a company of Kidrahil in the wilds of Anathpania. Of course, he had told no one of his intentions, least of all Sampas. The long view could not be trusted to those without vision. They must first blunder across the frontier.
Who?
Sampas asked of no one in particular. The others likewise peered, and though they sat stiff and still in their saddles, Confis knew they clawed their insides in anticipation, like children hankering for honey cakes. The fact that the approaching riders were dressed as Fainim meant nothing. With the exception of the Nansur, all men of the Tusk dressed like Fainim. Confis could not help but wonder what Martimus would think. Life had seemed more careful when reflected in his shrewd eyes, less reckless.
Exalt General!
Sampas abruptly cried. He made for his sword.
Hold! Confis barked. Draw no weapons!
But they're Kianine!
The general exclaimed. Fucking Biaxi. Small wonder they never managed to seize the mantle. Confis spurred forward, wheeling his mount about to face them.
Who but the wicked, he cried, would cast out the righteous?
To a man, they stared at him stupefied. They were all orthodox, which meant they despised the Prince of Atrathau as much as he, but their resolve was born of mundane earth, not heaven. Confis knew he could never ask too much of them. The bag of possible acts had no bottom when it came to men, but he could always ask too soon. These men would murder their mothers for him. It was simply a matter of timing. Confis smiled as one who had shared their many straits. He shook his head as if to say, "So here we find ourselves again."
"I've marched you to the frontiers of Galioth. I've led you into the heart of the dreaded Skilvendi Steppe. I've taken you to the very threshold of Kian's destruction. Kian! How many battles have we fought together? Lacentis, Duerna, Kaiuth, Mengeta, Anwarat, Terte. How many victories?"
He shrugged, as though at a loss how to make the obvious self-evident.
"And now look at us! Look at us! Imprisoned! The lands of our fathers stolen! The holy war in the grip of a false prophet! Inri Sejanus forgotten! You know as well as I the demands of war. The time has come for you to decide whether you're the equal of those demands."
Another gust wheeled across the slope, whisking through grasses, buffeting branches, forcing him to squint against the grit.
"Your hearts, my brothers! Ask them!"
It all came to their hearts in the end. Even though Confis had no clue what heart used in this sense actually meant, he did know that it could be trusted, like any other well-trained dog. He smiled inwardly, realizing the issue had been decided long before he had spoken. They were already committed. The genius of most men lay in finding reasons after their actions. The heart was ever self-serving, especially when the beliefs served involved sacrifice. This was why the great general always sought consent in the instant of commission. Momentum did the rest. Timing.
"You are the lion," Sampa said.
Then, as though baring their necks to the executioner, the others lowered their faces and held them there, chins to the red lacquered breastplates they wore over their chain hauberks. They let a long moment pass, a genanic sign of deep and reverent respect, even worship. Grinning, Confis wheeled his mount to the sound of approaching horsemen. There was a wild, unbridled air about the way they reined to a halt before him, as though the merest of whims had stayed their charge. Despite the many colors of their calots and the glint of their corselets, they seemed shadowy and threatening. It was more than the leather of their dark desert skin or the oiled luster of their long braided goatees. There was a haggard ferocity to their look. Their eyes gleamed with the manic resolve of put-upon peoples. A speechless moment passed, filled with the grunts and snorts of war horses. Confis almost laughed at the thought of his uncle confronting their ancestral foe in such a way, a mole bargaining with falcons, as opposed to a lion.
"Fanail ab Kaskamandri," he said in a clear and resonant voice. "Padiraja."
The young man he addressed bowed his head far too low. Fanail outranked all, save Zorias or Mathanet now.
"Aikuri Confis,"
the Padiraja of Kian said. his voice rich with lilting Kianine cadences. There was coal about his dark eyes.
Emperor!
When the rain stopped, he left her slumbering in their bed. Serwe, her face, as perfect as it was false. Nayor wandered from his apartments onto the terrace, breathed deep the cavernous after-storm air. Jaktha and her narrow ways extended into the distance, subdued beneath the clearing sky. It resembled a vast amphitheater, its tiers smashed and rutted. He stared for a time at Confus's compound on the far and opposite slopes, pondered it as though it were an uncharted shore. A burst of flapping startled him. Shadows flitted across the surrounding pools of water. Fleeing sand doves swept above, winging across the crescent moon, then jerking downward as though bound by strings to the terrace. Trilling in alarm, they vanished below. A voice rasped from his periphery.
You perplex me, Skilvendi.
Demons, Nayor now knew, had many guises. They were everywhere, mauling the world with their anarchic appetites, outraging with their impersonations. Birds, lovers, slaves, and most of all, him.
Kill the Ikuri, the voice keened, and the dogs will be loosed. Why do you stay your hand?
He turned to the abomination, to the bird. Certain peoples, Nayor knew, revered and reviled certain birds. The Nansur had their holy peacocks, the Sepalorans their prairie grouses, all in wreathy butchered kites and falcons in their rites of war. For the Skilvendi, however, birds were nothing more than signs of weather, wolves, and seasons. That and a food of last resort. So what was this thing? He had struck bargains with it, exchanged promises.
You speak to me of killing, Nayor said evenly, when the Dunyane's death should be your only concern.
The little face scowled.
The Ikuri plots the Holy War's destruction.
Nayor spat, turned to the plate of the Menenor, to the great finger of moonlight that divided its black back.
And the Dunyane?
We need him to find the other Moengis. He's the greater threat.
Fool,
Nayor exclaimed.
I eclipse you, mortal,
it replied with bird vehemence.
I am a son of a more violent race. You cannot conceive the compass of my life.
Nayor turned his profile to it, glanced at it sidelong.
Why? The blood that pulses through my veins is no less ancient, nor are the movements of my soul. You are not so old as the truth.
He could fairly hear the creature's sneer.
You still do not understand them, Nayor continued. Before all, the Dunyane are intellect. I do not know their ends, but I do know this. They make instruments of all things, and they do so with a way beyond the ken of me or even you, demon.
You think I underestimate them?
Nayor turned his back to the sea.
It is inevitable, he said, shrugging. We are little more than children to them, imbeciles drawn from the womb. Think on it, bird. Moengus has dwelt among the Kianine for 30 years. I know not your power, but I do know this. He lies far beyond it.
Moengus, simply speaking the name, cramped his heart.
As you say, Skilvendi, you know not my power.
Nayor cursed and laughed.
Would you like to know what a Dunyane would hear in your words?
And what might that be?
Posturing, vanity, weaknesses that betray your measure and offer innumerable lines of assault. A Dunyane would grant you your declarations. He would encourage you in your confidence. In all things he would dispense flattering appearances. He would care nothing whether you thought him your lesser, your slave, so long as you remained ignorant.
For a moment, the abomination simply stared, as though implications could only file singly through its apple-sized skull. Its face screwed into a miniature simulacrum of contempt.
Ignorant? Ignorant of what?
Nayor spat.
Your true circumstances.
And what are my true circumstances, Skilvendi?
That you are being played. that you flounder in nets of your own making. The circumstances you struggle to master, bird, have long ago mastered you. Of course, you think otherwise. Like men, power stands high among your native desires. But you are a tool as much as any man of the Tusk.
It crooked its head to the side.
How, then, am I to become my own instrument?
Nayur snorted.
For centuries you have manipulated events from the dark, or so you claim. Now you assume that you must do the same, that nothing has changed. I assure you, everything has changed. You think yourself hidden, but you are not. Chances are he already knows you have approached me. Chances are he already knows your ends and your resources.
Even the ancient things Nayor realized would suffer the Holy War's fate. The Dunyane would strip them the way the people stripped the carcasses of bison. Flesh for sustenance, fat for soap and fuel, bone for implements, hide for shelter and shields. No matter how deep they ran, the ages themselves would be consumed. The Dunyane was something new, perpetually new, like lust or hunger.
You must abandon your old ways, bird. You must strike across trackless ground. You must surrender brute circumstance to him, because in this you cannot hope to match him. Instead, you must watch. Wait. You must become a student of opportunity.
Opportunity? For what?
Nayor held out a scarred fist.
To kill him! To kill the Nasarimba Kellis while you still can!
He is not but a trifle,
the bird crowed.
So long as he leads the Holy War to Shaima, he works our will.
Fool,
Nayor cackled. The bird held forth its wings in wrath.
Do you not know who I am?
The pools about Nayor's feet flared bright with images of Srank loping through fire-gilded streets, of dragons climbing tormented skies, of human heads smoking about bronze rings, and of a high-winged monstrosity, blazing eyes and translucent flesh.
Behold!
But Nayor held his trinket fast in his fist. He was not cowed.
Sorcery?
He laughed.
You merely toss shanks to the wolves of my argument. Even as we speak, he learns sorcery.
The light vanished, and only the bird remained, its human head white in the moonlight.
The mandate schoolman, Nayor said in explanation. He teaches him.
It will take him years, you fool.
Nayor spat, managed to shake his head ruefully despite the mad disproportion between the thing before him and the aura of its might. Pity for the powerful. Did that not make one great?
You forget, bird. He learned my people's tongue in 4 days.
Kneeling naked in his apartments, he neither moved nor started at the sound of approaching footsteps. He was Aikuri Confus the First. And though he had no choice but to continue this obscene pantomime with the Skilvendi, surprise was ever the grist of victory. His subordinates were a different matter altogether. At long last, the days of censoring his words and rationing his actions were over. His uncle's spies were now his spies, and he knew quite well the length and beam of his own sedition.
The Sake Grand Master has arrived,
Sampas said from the darkness behind him.
Just Kemen Khetri,
Confus replied.
No one else?
Your instructions were explicit, God of Men.
The Emperor smiled.
Wait with him. I come shortly.
Never had he been so desperate for information. The anxiousness was so acute that he had no choice but to master it. The hunger that whined the loudest should always be the last fed. One must have discipline about the imperial table. He barked into the gloom after the general had departed. A naked Kianine girl crept forward, her eyes wide in terror. Confus patted the rug before him, watched impassively as she assumed the position, knees spread, shoulders down, peach raised, before him. Hiking his kilt, he knelt between her orange legs. He need only strike her once before she learned to hold the mirror steady. But as he began to minister to her, another far better idea came upon him. He bid her hold the mirror before his face, so that her own reflection stared down upon her. "Watch yourself," he cooed. "Watch, and the pleasure will come, I swear it." For some reason, the cold press of silver against his cheek fanned his ardor. They climaxed together, despite her shame. It made her seem more than the animal he knew her to be. He would make, he decided, a far different emperor from his uncle. 7 days had passed since his meeting with Fenile, and still the point had not taken. Confis was not one to fret over omens. He had watched his fool uncle twist from that wire for far too long, but he could not help but mourn the circumstance of his investiture. To rise to the mantle of the Nansorium while prisoner of a Skilvendi, and to learn of it from a Kianine, from the Padiraja, no less. Though the humiliation meant nothing to him, it was an irony too sharp not to smack of the gods. What if his candle had burned to the stub? What if they did begrudge their brothers? The timing was all wrong. Momim was almost certainly in an uproar. According to Fenile sources, Ngaro, his uncle's grand seneschal, had taken matters in hand, hoping to secure Confis's favor upon his return. Fenile had insisted that his succession was secure, that no one either on or off the Andiamine Heights would dare foment against the great Lion of Kaiuth. And though Confis's vanity assured him this was true, he could not overlook the fact that this was precisely what the newly anointed Padiraja needed him to believe. Though the Holy War lay far from Nensophon and the White Sun Palace, Kian stood upon the brink of an abyss, and if Confis rushed to Momim to secure his claim, Fenile would be doomed. What son of the salt would not say anything to save his nation? 2 things had convinced him to remain in Jokthe and continue this farce with the Skilvendi: the prospect of crossing Kamema once again, and the fact that, according to Fenile, it had been his grandmother who had killed Zarius. As mad as the notion seemed, and as much as Fenile's protestations had provoked his suspicion, he somehow knew that this simply had to be what had happened. Years before, she had killed her husband to install her beloved son, and now she had killed her son to install her beloved grandson, and perhaps more importantly, to bring him home. From the beginning, Istria had balked at the notion of betraying the Holy War. Confis had forgiven her this, knowing that the old have eyes keen for encroaching shadows. What dusk does not bring thoughts of dawn? It was the intensity of her aversion that worried him. Claws such as hers did not grow brittle with age, as his uncle had apparently discovered. The murder was entirely consistent with her character, of course. Canine avarice was ever the hook from which all her motives hung. She had assassinated Zarius, not for the sake of the Holy War, but for the sake of her precious soul. Confis found himself snorting in derision whenever the thought struck him. One might sooner wash shit from shit than cleanse a soul so wicked. But in the absence of facts to fix them, these thoughts and worries could do naught but cycle round and round, quickened by the mad stakes and the perverse unreality of it all. "I'm emperor," he would think. "Emperor!" But as things stood, he was a prisoner of his ignorance, far more so than of the Skilvendi. And with his sake caller, Durastius, dead, there was nothing to be done about it, save wait. He found the old man prostrate on the floor beneath the impromptu dais and chairs Sampas had arranged for him. The Skilvendi had installed him and his officers in a burnt brick manse near the center of Jokthe, an old Nansur exchange house, as luck would have it, and though technically he was free to wander where he might, a watch had been set on all the building's entrances. Fortunately for them, the Conryans were a civilized people, sharing a civilized appreciation for bribes. Confis took his place on the dais, stared across what had once been a money changer's floor. In the gloom, bland mosaics wandered across the walls, conjuring a peculiar sense of home. An acrid edge of smoke plagued his every breath. Thanks to the Skilvendi, they had been reduced to burning furnishings. Sampas stood discreetly in the same outer gloom as the slaves. Between four glowering braziers, the man lay face first on a gold and purple prayer mat, pillaged from some tabernacle, Confis supposed. Despite the thousand questions that raced through his soul, he gazed at him in silence for a long moment, noted the shine of his pate through strings of white hair. Finally, he said, "I take it you've heard as well." Of course, the man said nothing. Clever as he was, Kemenketri was a savant when it came to the finer points of court etiquette. According to ancient custom, the emperor was not to be addressed without explicit consent. Few emperors bothered with the antique protocol, as it was called. But now, with Zorias dead, ancient precedent was all that remained. The crossbow had been fired. Now everything had to be reset. "You have my leave to rise," Confis said. "I hereby rescind the antique protocol. You may look me in the eye whenever you wish, Grand Master." Two milk-white slaves, Galioth or Sepulorin, ducked in from the dark to raise the man by his elbows. Confis was vaguely shocked. The past months had been hard on the old fool. Hopefully he had the strength Confis required. "Emperor," the white-haired sorcerer murmured while the slaves brushed the wrinkles from his black silk gown. "God of men." There it was. His new name. "So, tell me, Grandmaster, what does the Imperial Sake make of these events?" Kemenketri studied him in the narrow way that, Confis knew, had always unnerved his uncle. "But not me."
"We've waited long," the frail schoolman said, "for one who might truly wield us. For an emperor."
Confis grinned. Kemenketri was an able man, and able men chafed under the rule of ingrates. The man could boast no ancestor scroll, but then sorcerers rarely could. He was Shirapti, a descendant of those Shigeki who had fled following the Imperial Army's disastrous defeat at Huparna centuries before. The fact that he had risen to the rank of Grand Master despite these defects, Shirapti were widely seen as thieves and usurers, spoke to his ability. But could he be trusted? Of all the schools, only the Imperial Sake answered to mundane powers. Only they remained an organ of their state. Since Zorias believed all men as vain and treacherous as himself, he simply assumed they secretly resented their servitude, when in reality it had been his distrust they despised. The Imperial Sake, Confis knew, revered their traditions. They took deep pride in the fact that they alone honored the old compactorium, the ancient indenture that had bound all the schools to Kanae and her aspect emperors in near antiquity. The Sake alone had kept this venerable faith. They thought the others, especially the Scarlet Spires, little more than usurpers, reckless arrogates whose greed threatened the very existence of the few. All men recited self-aggrandizing stories, words of ascendancy and exception, to balm the inevitable indignities of fact. An emperor need only repeat those stories to command the hearts of men. But this axiom had always escaped Zorias. He was too bent on hearing his own story repeated to learn, let alone speak, the flatteries that moved other men. "I assure you, Kemenketri, the Imperial Sake will be wielded and with all the respect and consideration accorded by the Compactorium. You alone have prevailed over what is base and wanton. You alone have kept faith with the glory of your past." Something akin to triumph brightened the man's mien.
"You honor us, God of men."
"Is all ready?"
"Very nearly so, God of men."
Confis nodded and exhaled. He reminded himself to be methodical, disciplined.
"Has Sompas told you of Durastius?"
"Durastius and I shared the same compass in Momum, so I learned that he'd fallen silent while in transit. For a time I feared the worst, God of men. It brings me immeasurable relief to find you and your designs intact."
Collar and compass, the two poles of every sorceress communication. The compass was the anchor, the schoolman who slept in the place known by the caller, who entered his dreams bearing messages. This, Confess knew, was but one of many reasons his uncle had harbored such suspicion of the Sake. So many of the Empire's communications passed through them. He who controlled the messenger controlled the message as well. Which reminded him.
You know of the Scarlet Schoolman assigned to the Skilvendi? Sornemi, his name is. No word of what happens here can reach the Holy War.
He let his gaze communicate the Stakes. Kemen Ketri's eyes had grown porcine with age, but they were sharp still.
If you deliver him alive, God of Men, we can ensure that the Scarlet Fools will think all is well in Jokhtha. We need only incapacitate him before his assigned contact time. Our compulsions will do the rest. He will tell his handlers whatever you wish, and Erastius will be amply avenged, I assure you.
Confess nodded, realizing for the first time that it was imperial favor he dispensed now. He hesitated, only for a heartbeat, but it was enough.
You wish to know what happened, Kemen Ketri said. How your uncle fell?
He stooped for a moment, then drew upright in what seemed a breath of resolution.
I know only what my compass has told me. Even so, there's much we must discuss, God of Men.
I imagine there is, Confess said, waving with indulgent impatience. But the near before the far, Grandmaster, the near before the far. We have a Skilvendi to break.
He stared at the schoolman with bland humor. And a holy war to annihilate.